Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features Roy Ozakowitz discussing High Times, the extraordinary life of a Joburg dope smuggler. High Times recounts the true story of Michael Medjuk, who rose from the late 1960s Johannesburg to become one of North America's most notorious hash and weed smugglers. Operating from Vancouver, Michael built a vast smuggling network across Canada and the United States, funding a life of luxury and excess. In 1991, he was caught by the US federal agents with a massive shipment of Afghani hash, leading to his conviction and a 24-year prison sentence. His legendary prison experiences eventually ended with an early release. However, he was soon arrested again in Spain for cocaine smuggling, resulting in another 9-year term. Told by Roy and the late Jeremy Gordon, this is Michael's incredible story. In this episode, Roy engages in an exhilarating conversation with Michael. It's an absolute adventure. Enjoy.
Michael.
Yes, Roy. How are you today?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Really good. Beautiful day here. Been up early. Sun comes up early. It's
must
beautiful
be
weather.
Hot now.
Yes, it does. July, August is hurricane season, so it's starting to get hot.
Okay, well, our book, which we've been talking about for many years, working on intensively for the last two, I guess, is about to come out. High Times, subtitled The Extraordinary Life of a Joburg Dope Smuggler. That's you.
That's me.
How do you feel that?
Well, you know, it's interesting you asking that because I have felt about it. And, you know, in my heyday when I was kind of at top of the heap and your ego's out of control and you have all these people following you, telling you how great you are, and you're kind of famous within a group of people. And then, of course, your whole world collapses and you go to prison for 21 years. And then you get out and you want to be really humble and appreciative and grateful for your life as it is now, having changed in so many ways, that for the first time, you start thinking about, well, you know, we did this book because we think it's going to be a great book and good stories and people be interested in it. And I actually might become famous again. Of course, as I've told you before, I'm really interested in doing a series and possibly a movie, but not so much about me, but more about the era I came from. So that thought has come to me. Well, if you become famous again, and you know how we all dream, you're at the Oscar nominations and they nominated it for something. Well, can I handle it? Well, yes, I can, but I'll handle it much differently than I did my first time around in being more humble and appreciative of my life. And my past isn't something I can change, and just living with it.
Yeah, I guess so. For the sake of listeners who don't yet know the story, I'll just say very briefly that the book traces how you rose to become one of the most prominent Dacha smugglers, although, of course, in North America, it's not called Dacha, but grass or marijuana or hash, to become the most prominent Dacha smugglers in North America. You were finally, after 20-odd years, arrested. You spent a total of 21 years in prison, some of the world's grimmest prisons, as far as I can tell. It's an amazing story. Do you have regrets?
Well, you know, you like to say you don't have regrets just because it makes you feel better. And of course, my mistakes that I made, I do admit to. And I was a different age and a different person. So, yes, I do have regrets. I have regrets about, you know, what my wife went through, what my kids went through visiting me in prison. And, you know, the family part of it, of course, is completely destroyed. But in the end, the way I feel now, being much more humble and grateful for being alive and healthy, I try to take out the positive side of what I did. Of course, the negative side was my ego was out of control. You know, I thought I was infallible, but I can't change all of that. That's the way I was before. Now I see it differently. My regrets are there in the people I hurt. And a bit like AA, when you get out of prison, all you can do is clean up your side of the street. And whether people forgive you for what you did, you have no control over. So you just deal with it. That is the way I do.
Yeah, good one. And you had some great times in between.
I always think back on the great times. You know, Roy, you and I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. And you know how music means so much to us. The Beatles, of course. And living in South Africa, we couldn't listen to any of the music. We'd have to tune into Lorenzo Marx, now named Maputo, in Mozambique, because they had stations and we were a big audience in listening to rock and roll.
Right.
So every time I think of it, sometimes a song goes on and it reminds me of a place and time I was and how, you know, just the story of how it all happened and fell into place. And luck played a big part of it. And yeah, so that's my reply.
So I then want to know what role you think being in South Africa at that time played in your eventual career and what you did and what happened to you. Do you think those years of being in South Africa and the family situation were important?
Very important. I mean, I'm sure Freud said the same thing. Your youthfulness and your youthful years are what develop you to the person you are. Mm. And, you know, I can always remember with my dad walking along the street and smelling marijuana and saying, "Dad, what's that awful smell?" And he would say, "Oh, it's just the African smoking tobacco." And of course, later on, we realized that, you know, marijuana was part of the African culture for hundreds of years. And of course, when we were smoking marijuana, it was often in protest to the system as much as it was in getting high, because we just wanted to go against all the norms that our parents had.
Right.
So that part of South Africa really influenced me. And of course, coming from a family that really wasn't wealthy, my dad working at the OK Bazaars, my mom had a secretarial business, I wanted to achieve. And, you know, living around me were all these kids who had parents that were very wealthy and successful. So in a way, it was part of the drive that made me become
sort of
successful.
Challenged you.
Yeah, it challenged me. And that was part of, you know, South Africa, how big sports was. And sports was such an influence on all of us in making us want to be the best we could be and getting to the top.
Continuing from that, right? You and I started smoking dacha at exactly the same time. I think it was around about 1967, right?
Right.
And in the same place, Johannesburg. And yet, and I would go so far as to say for both of us, it was a life-changing experience. But
yes,
you became a professional. I remained an amateur, you know, the weekend smoker and stuff like that. So what do you think it was that made you, A, become a professional dealer and then as good at it as you were?
Well, you know, as you know, which is like a small story in the book of people sending me shoeboxes of marijuana.
Right.
Because
right.
Back in the early 1970s, it would be in a cardboard box.
Just to make it clear, you were in Canada. Ready. Yeah.
In Vancouver.
Right.
And friends would send me shoebox or maybe with a pound of marijuana or half a pound in the mail. And because there was no inspections in those days, I would get it from the postman, which in today's terms seems outrageous. Of course, at first, going to university, I would just share it with my friends. Then one day, a couple of friends sent me a Tupperware full, and it had probably a couple of pounds, maybe a kilo in it. And I thought, geez, we can't smoke all this. What are we going to do? And a friend said, if you put them in these little bags, they call them lids, you can get $12 each. So that was kind of what started me off. I had a student loan and I didn't have any money. So I thought, you know, this would be a good source of income. And soon that developed into other things that got me into the business. And the first one, as I mentioned to you before, was a house I was living in. People would come over to smoke because they knew, God, this guy's got this weed that's, you know.
And it was African weed.
I mean, exactly. It wasn't.
In those days, America, you were only doing, or Canada, you were only doing Mexican shit. And that was bad.
Yeah, which was bad. Exactly. So this guy came by from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he had heard that hash was cheaper in Vancouver. And did I know anyone who had any for sale? I knew somebody from this place I used to hang out at, a friend's house, who knew somebody who just brought in a Volkswagen bus with like 30 pounds in it, hidden under the floor of the back of the Volkswagen bus. And I went over there and he had 17 pounds left. And this friend from Pittsburgh had enough money to buy it. And we bought it. And I put it in the back seat of my Volkswagen Bug in the Springs. I drove to Seattle. He met me in Seattle. We jumped on the airplane and put it in the overhead because in those days there was no inspection. We flew to Chicago and then changed planes and flew to Pittsburgh. And Nick became my mentor. And I could go through stories, which many are in the book, of what Nick was doing. Nick was doing. So that's essentially the story of how I got into it. And Nick, being the typical American capitalist, was into it for the money more than to change the world. And one of the first things he told me was I had to cut my hair.
Right, right. The hippie look
it was no good. And when we'd drive past this area in Pittsburgh called Shadyside, which was the hippie area of Pittsburgh, and you'd say, Michael, you see all those long-haired guys? He said, none of them are smoking the good weed we are. We have the best weed from Acapulco and other places, and we've got short hair and nobody's suspicious of us. So that was the lifestyle I then started to live, of hiding the fact I was smuggling or selling weed.
Right. But over the years, you became to be a businessman and investor of some renown in Vancouver. I mean, people didn't know what the core business was at the time, but you spread out into a whole bunch of businesses, including a lot of real estate up in Whistler in the skiing resort.
Yes, you know, part of my format was that every day I'd wake up and wear a suit and tie, and I'd pretend I was a businessman. And on the side, of course, my whole business was smuggling. But because I was making so much money, I realized soon that I had to invest it in something. And as you know, a few of the stories are from the book of how I was lucky enough and smart enough to use South Africa's apartheid system to help me launder money.
Little trick with Kruger Rands, and I'm sure
right.
A lot of people find it very interesting. But I want to move on to the fact that however wealthy you became, and you became very wealthy, and whatever good times you had, and you had incredible times, things do come to an end. And you were busted first in September 1991 for not only your largest load, as far as I know, but the largest load ever busted in the United States, and that was 72 tons of Afghani hash.
Yes.
You know, I don't think we'll go through all the legal complications. It was a very it became a very important legal case as well. But you, after that, spent 22 years in prisons, which I think most of the people listening will find unfathomable. How does one get through so many years in such conditions? What are the sort of inequalities that you need, and maybe some external stuff as well? I'm sure some external stuff as well, to survive those years.
Well, Roy, you know, it's like so much in life. As we get older, you learn along the way. So yeah. When you first get in, you know, you talk about things you don't need to talk about in terms of your life and everything else. And, you know, everybody's got a case that they have that's the most important thing to them. And you just have to be smart enough to learn on subjects to talk about and subjects not to talk about. You know, when you meet white guys who are racist, you're not there to criticize them or tell them the way they should be.
Yeah. And Michael, I'm just going to stop you for 1 second to make it clear to people that though you were Canadian, and you are Canadian, you were arrested in the United States, and you did your prison term in the United States at the height of the war on Reagan-Nixon war on drugs.
That's correct, Roy. And there were so many people in jail at the time for smuggling and trafficking marijuana or hash or, you know, one of the soft drugs. And you're right, I just got caught up in an era where, in many ways, the DEA didn't have any restrictions as long as they caught people. And, of course, the whole system was based on if you could get one person to roll on the other person, it was easy to convict them, just like they did with John Gotti, who they couldn't convict for many years till Sammy the Bull testified against him. When you first go to jail, it's just such a different world that you're not used to after the lifestyle you've lived. And you just have to really learn and listen, you know, to what people tell you about it and assess things yourself. But of course, when you're in jail, and when I went up, I still had some money left. And people knew, because of the size of my case, I must have money. So you have to be really careful with predators or people who befriend you, who are only doing it in the hope of the long term, they might be able to borrow some money for you or, you know, whatever.
Right. Lift a lot off you.
Yes. So, you know, the violence and everything else, I had quite a few fights, which I won't get into. You see a lot of violence with stabbing and everything, and it just reminds you that you have to be on your constant awareness of where you are and what's around you. When you're in a maximum prison and you walk past somebody, you don't brush against them or touch them at all. When you're walking past the cells, you don't look in someone else's cell,
right?
And it's rude to do that.
And on top of everything else, you were not only white, but you were Jewish. Did that make a difference?
Well, it did, because, you know, most, there are not a lot of Jewish guys in jail. Of course, there are.
In America.
But in the one prison I was in, mostly in Florence, Colorado, the maximum, I was the only Jewish guy there most of the time. And, you know, you hear conversations. People come to the dining table where four people sit around, and the guy says, "That Howard Stern, that damn Jew, I really hate all Jews." And you've just got to sit there and not say a word. Or you're in the dining hall and it's Hitler's birthday, and a bunch of Aryan Brotherhood guys bring a cake out and do Hail Hitler in memory of his birthday. What can you do? You just accept it, and
right.
You can't. So those things happen.
And you, if I'm not mistaken, you've been out of prison now for 10 years. I think you got released in 2014. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. 11 years next.
11 years
next,
next
February.
Year. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is your 10th year. And I mean, what does it feel like? You remember those days, but have you adjusted? Can you believe you went through all that shit?
You know, in some ways, of course, I do believe I went through all that shit.
How do people on the outside relate to a former prisoner? Do you find there's issues? You tell people you were locked up to, like they shrink. You know what I mean? What's it like?
Well, Roy, we use the laughing comment of we were in college. We, you know, I was in college for so many years when I mention it to people who know about it. But generally, you know, in a way, I'm proud of what I did and I got through. And it's not something I'm ashamed of. So
right.
Most people I meet when they hear it's hash and everything from a bygone era, I've never been a member of a cartel or smuggled heroin or
right.
guns or anything. So it's, you know, from a totally different era in terms of, if people don't like that, then that's their problem, not mine.
And it's worth noting, of course, that what you were busted for is now legal in Canada and legal in a lot of the US.
Right. I mean, it's almost the joke of, well, reparation. I should get money from the marijuana stores, all the guys who went to prison, because we the guys who made it happen. And in a way, Roy, I think we always knew that one day it would be legal.
We did. We did. So, though, yeah, it took us a while, but we did. So now, since, 2016, 17, you've been living in Cabo, Los Cabos, in Mexico, which people who've been there have told me is the most gorgeous place. How's life now? And importantly, do you ever get an itch to get back into the business?
No, I never get the itch to be back in it. I'm
no.
just grateful I made it through what I did. And of course, people have made proposals to me, but if, you know, I've always turned it down
right.
just because I don't want to anymore. And I'm happy where I am now. I love living here. It's a slow lifestyle. And, you know, as they I said before, I feel blessed and grateful with my life now. And it has nothing to do with money or anything else. It's just in being healthy. You know, there've been so many positive things about prison of, you know, teaching yoga, exercising a lot. And it's
right.
done me a lot of good till now.
I mean, you're the fittest guy your age that I know.
Yes, I am.
You're still built like a 36-year-old.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you. Yeah, I pride myself on that. And it's lots of motivation of, you know, the positive side of prison. I probably wouldn't be in this shape had I not done 20 years or so.
Oh, that's And your kids, are you close to your kids these days?
Yes, I really am. And it's taken quite a few years of me getting out to, you know, achieve that. And we're very close and they are just happy to see me happy living in Cabo. And I'm really lucky. I have two wonderful children who have done really well in their lives and both have grandchildren. And yeah, I'm just really in a good space as far as the children and relationships with family are concerned.
Not bad for an old dope smuggler, eh?
Not bad at all. It's so sad still, Roy, because there's so many guys doing long-term sentences who
Have
are
you?
getting old and sick and are still in jail for marijuana in the US federally. But that's a whole complicated legal thing. Really, it
So,
should be legal and let everybody out who's been jail for marijuana.
absolutely. So we're going to end it there. The all Michael's adventures, the good and the bad, will be available shortly. High Times, The Extraordinary Life of a Joburg Dope Smuggler, published by Jonathan Ball. Thank you all for listening.
Thanks, Roy. Take care.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.